Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Every year, the realm of digital health continues to push the envelope with innovative solutions, things you hadn't even thought you needed, for diagnosing, monitoring, and treating illnesses, to advancements in healthcare delivery and smarter lifestyles. In fact, it's estimated that by 2018, in 2 short years, more than 80 million adults will use some sort of wearable device for health and wellness. Earlier this month, a number of health gadgets made their debut at the 2016 Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. Joining us now to talk about it is managing editor at Mobi Health News, Jonah Comstock. Welcome to the show, Jonah.
Thanks, Ann. Good to be here.
Did the health and wellness sector at the event seem larger than in past years?
Well, that's an interesting question, actually. we've been tracking health and wellness at CES for 7 years, and we really feel that it peaked around 2014. But that's not all a bad thing. It's become such an established category now that it's not where the big hype machine of CES is focused. But there's still a sizable presence there, I think.
So what was the big news this year?
You know, we saw a lot of every year at CES, you see a lot of kind of Me Toos from companies that are trying to get on board with whatever the current biggest health gadget is, especially in the fitness tracking space. Mm-hmm. But I would say the really innovative stuff or the really interesting stuff this year, the one that topped our list was Under Armour, which was originally kind of a sports apparel company, but got into fitness last year when it purchased a bunch of different health and fitness apps. And so it's been in fitness software for about 2 years, but at CES they announced they're going to get into the hardware game with a Fitbit-style wrist-worn tracker and a heart strap and a connected scale. So that's a really big move from a really interesting company.
Is it a smart move? I mean, is that a growing, do you see that as a really growing market?
You know, it's hard to say. Fitbit IPO'd last year, got a lot of people very excited about it. Obviously, you know, just anecdotally, I know more people who wear fitness trackers who use them than I used to. But it's also a very crowded space, so it's bold of Under Armour to say, you know, we're gonna push in here now. But you know, they are doing a few things that are a little different with their platform. They're really leaning on the software and the investment they made in apps, and they're selling this as kind of their health box, which instead of selling three devices a la carte, they're hoping people will sort of buy into a scale and a tracker and a heart rate strap all at once. And they're selling this kind of whole health monitoring experience at a much higher price point. So, again, that's kind of a risky move, but it'll be interesting to see how it plays out for them.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about new gadgets in health and wellness that are out there, new technology. If you have a question or comment, my guest is Jonah Comstock. He's managing editor at Mobi Health News, and you can give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Earlier this month, a lot of health gadgets made their debut or recurred at the 2016 Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. Samsung showed off a wearable ECG patch. What is it and how does it work?
Well, you know, we don't know entirely. One thing about this show is that the companies sort of will give you their biggest and their brightest shot for the year ahead, and they'll give you varying degrees of information about it.
Okay.
So some are more forthcoming than others. But, you know, Samsung has made a big bet on health monitoring lately, and this patch in particular that, you know, it looks like something that could be integrated with, you know, with some of their phones for kind of, for, you know, health tracking. yeah, I was trying to find a little more on that one.
Yeah.
But it was kind of part of a big pitch by Samsung. One of their focuses is the Internet of Things. And so they want to incorporate health tracking into your life. So part of that is they showed off a new smart fridge that's also going to be able to display the statistics of your workout tracked from whatever wearable you use. They should have a smart belt that's going to, you know, track your waist size and put that in the context of how much you're working out and how much you're eating. So, you know, I would look at this, the patch, which is, you know, kind of a adhesive wearable tracking device that tracks heart rate, as eventually going to be kind of part of a connected ecosystem for them of fitness devices.
I kind of figured that when it came to something like Under Armour, that was sort of what their shtick was going to be, the fitness monitoring clothing.
Yeah, and I think they, you know, they tried that sort of as a direct outgrowth of their clothing business before they bought all these apps. And I think the time just wasn't quite right for it or something. But Under Armour is really, it's really in an interesting place. A lot of people are saying, you know, why is this apparel brand suddenly interested in health and fitness? Why are they suddenly interested?
Well, I mean, it's a fitness clothing brand.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. But the, you know, the question people were asking at first when they bought all these apps is, how are these apps going to help them sell more shoes and sell more clothes? And what we're starting to see now is maybe they're thinking a little bigger than that. This is sort of a whole new additional business for them, which also will help them sell more shoes and help them sell more clothes. But
right. You write that Intel made a few announcements. What are they looking at?
Yeah, so Intel's, a lot of their stuff at CES this year was partnership based. So they they've created this new computer chip, Curie, and they're sort of using some of these fitness and sports examples to show what it can do. And in the process, they've kind of created some smart, you know, always one of the things we see is people are updating fitness tracking, health tracking technology for a lot of different sports. So they built the chip into a BMX bike, and they built it into a snowboard, and they sort of had a showed that off in their keynote and the ways that it can, you know, track different things that are particular to these sports.
I would imagine when Intel makes an announcement, it's a big hairy deal. Was there anything more under the radar that caught your eye that maybe, you know, they don't have the resources and whatnot to make a splash, but it was there?
Well, my favorite announcement this year, or the one that I thought was the most interesting that I think falls into that category, is actually L'Oreal, the cosmetic company, teamed up with a company that's very familiar to us. It's actually based right here with me in Cambridge, Massachusetts, called MC10. And what it is, and we're not exactly sure how they're going to incorporate it into their consumer product offerings, but it's an kind of like an electronic tattoo. Like it's like a skin patch, either a sticker or a temporary tattoo that will track your UV radiation. And they're going to somehow package it with their sunscreen. So, you know, you buy a sunscreen and you get this stick-on patch that can beam information to your phone about how much UV you're getting.
That is interesting.
Yeah, we've seen this technology in development. People have been talking about different kinds of, you know, smart tattoos, smart stickers for a long time. But the question has been, how is that actually going to make its way into a consumer market? And so this is the first use case of how that might happen. And it's obviously a really interesting partner. So that's one to keep an eye on. I think Wythings, which is formerly a French company, now based in France and in the United States, that that makes a lot of different health tracking devices. They already had a blood pressure monitor and a scale and a tracker. Their new thing this year in the health devices category was a thermometer. And it's not just a thermometer like you would have where you put it under your tongue or under your armpit. This is an infrared thermometer that you hold just a few inches from your temple, and it non-invasively detects temperature. So that's interesting for people with kids. It's interesting. You
know, yeah, you're like, I think my associate producer's head just exploded over that.
Yeah,
that's a huge deal.
Yeah, I think we're definitely seeing people think, you know, really critically asking, you know, what are the health devices people are using in the house, and how can we make those connected, not just in a way that, hey, it's connected to your phone, but also, you know, how does that connectivity really help people in their lives? There was another one that the Washington Post was very interested in. It was a smartphone-connected pregnancy test.
Yeah.
And that one received some pushback from people who were like, well, why does this have to be smartphone-connected? You know, I think it's a fair question as they try to market that.
Well, how does it even work? I don't get it.
You know, it's about twice as much in cost as a regular pregnancy test. And what you get is, instead of just turning a different color, it sends a message to your phone. And then you've got an app. And built into that app are sort of different entertainment things to kind of keep you occupied during that waiting time while the test is finishing. And then once it returns your result, it, you know, links you to resources that might be helpful if you are pregnant, if you are not pregnant, depending on whether or not you want it to be. So it's sort of just an attempt to use the smartphone connectivity to build up that experience of taking a pregnancy test.
A first world style experience, right?
Yeah, that's definitely a way to put it.
Do you get a sense, I think you mentioned, you might have answered this earlier, but I want to double check, that we've sort of stabilized when it comes to the wearables like Fitbit and that kind of a thing? Or are we moving away from them? Or do you think it's turning into belts and clothes and that kind of, and tattoos?
Yeah, there's a lot of different trends happening, and I think we'll have to get a little further back from before we see exactly how it shapes up. But one big obvious one is the smartwatch phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
So the Apple Watch came out last year, and their sort of position is, why would you get a device that just tracks your fitness when you could get this device on the wrist that, you know, also keeps track of your appointments and tells you about texts and phone calls and also tracks your fitness? So a big question has been, what's the place for the, you know, Fitbit-type fitness tracking wearables in a world where you're hopefully you've got a smartphone on your wrist that does that and more? But the way we're seeing that play out is actually that a lot of people maybe aren't interested in that anymore. You know, they're still just very interested in having a fitness device that does one thing.
Well,
plus, yeah.
Go ahead. I mean, is the cost.
Right. Yeah, the cost is a huge thing, and there have been some reports about that recently, too, about the price point. But I think that will go down, just like it has gone down with all these devices.
Were you there last year? I mean, is there anything that came out of 2015 that surprised you or that you've seen kind of come to fruition?
Yeah, so we've tracked... like I said, we've tracked it for 7 years. We've done these slideshows where we try to get every show since 2013.
Okay.
So last year, and the other thing we do is every December we go through and we look at the ones that were announced last year and we see, did they actually come out when they were supposed to? Did they cost what they were supposed to?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking over last year's right now to see kind of what the biggest ones that actually made a difference were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for a lot of them, I think it's still too early. Like, some of the ones that came out last year that were really interesting either haven't come out yet or they've come out and it's still kind of, we're still kind of seeing whether they're really going to catch on or make a difference.
Right.
You know, there's one company called Breathometer, and they're backed by Mark Cuban, so they've got some kind of pretty interesting pedigree, and they came out with a device. Their first product was a smart breathalyzer that connects to your smartphone. You can use to see whether you're good to drive home. And they announced a device for Aura Health that would be kind of a new kind of tracker that would tell you, you know, about this state of your hydration or your mouth. And that seemed like a really interesting new avenue, but nothing really seems to have come of it so far. And then the other big one was that could be huge if it turns out to be a real thing, but still hasn't come out yet. It's called SIO by Consumer Physics. And that's a consumer spectrometer that you could point at your food and it would tell you things about the chemical content or the nutrition or the calorie count. And that space has a history of a lot of sort of sketchy products and snake oil sales, so
uh-huh.
Nobody's kind of too ready to say, hey, that's going to be a real thing. But if it is, obviously that would change a lot about the way that we, you know, track our nutrition and our food as the other piece of that calories in, calorie out thing.
Yeah, that would be pretty cool, sort of Jetson-y. So maybe we're getting close to that.
But a lot of times the most important announcements as far as things that actually come out and people use are just around the, Fitbit trackers, the Jawbone, the Y-things,
Right.
Things like that.
Okay. Well, Jonah Comstock, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
It's Jonah Comstock, Managing Editor at Mobi Health News. We'll have a link to that at our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Nearsightedness, farsightedness, blurred vision, cataracts, glaucoma. If you weren't blessed with 20/20 vision, you're definitely not alone. Key breakthroughs in ophthalmology during the last 20 years, though, have included new surgery techniques and improved equipment, and they're bringing new hope to patients with debilitating eye conditions. Joining us now in the studio is ophthalmologist and director of laser vision correction at Arena Eye Surgeons in Columbus, Dr. Curtin Kelly. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
Let's start with something most people think they get, which is LASIK surgery. When it was first introduced, there were a lot of questions, but now it seems practically normal. But if you could, for those of us who just like get squeamish at the thought of it, tell us what actually happens with LASIK surgery.
Well, LASIK, first of all, has been around for better part of 22 years
yeah.
now in the United States and almost 30 worldwide. So it's a very time-tested procedure. It is probably the safest eye surgery done. It involves two steps. The front of your eye, called the cornea, is first elevated with a flap. And then underneath the flap, the laser is used to recontour your eye to eliminate your nearsightedness or your farsightedness or your astigmatism.
Could you do both?
You can do any of those.
Okay.
Almost any prescription can be treated now with LASIK surgery as long as you fit a couple of parameters. You can't laser very, very high prescriptions if your cornea is a bit thin or if
okay.
you have a couple of diseases. But most people are candidates if they don't fall into some of the extremes of corneal thinning or have severe rheumatoid arthritis or one of the few reasons not to do LASIK. But overall, most people are, and a lot of people don't realize the range of prescriptions you can actually treat.
How has it changed over that 22 years that it's been in place in the United States?
Well, it started only being able to treat pure nearsightedness.
Okay.
And then in the late 90s, evolved to be able to treat astigmatism, and early 2000s, farsightedness, and the range and the way that the treatments are delivered has improved. There are several different laser technologies now that we use. We can manipulate the actual flap. Some patients don't even get a flap. A predecessor surgery called PRK has been around since the late 80s. So that technology of doing it has grown exponentially, literally, over the last 20 years now.
We're talking about different kinds of treatments for vision impairment. My guest is Dr. Curtin Kelly. He's an ophthalmologist and director of the laser vision correction at Arena Eye Surgeons. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Don't wait too long. Get your question or comment in early. As far as LASIK goes, it seems like back 20, 22 years ago, the people that I knew that had it then were told that it might not last, that they might have to have a refresher done later in life.
Actually, as it turns out, it does last. It creates a very permanent change of your vision. What I think most people find changing is, I call the birthday count. They've
yeah.
gotten to the point where their near vision starts to fail, and it's not because the LASIK wore off. It's because they typically would be buying bifocals.
So they would have probably in the early days had, it would have been to see far away. And then
that's correct. If you set both eyes for pure distance, by the time you're 45 or 46, you'll start to need reading glasses, with or without LASIK surgery. It doesn't bring it on. It's just sort of ignores that. It sets your eyes where you choose.
It's referred to as refractive surgery. What does that mean?
Refraction is the basis of figuring out whether you're near or farsighted, and using LASIK to reverse that, it means you're changing the refraction of your eye towards a target, whether you want near vision or far vision. For pure distance vision, you'd have zero refraction, so this surgery is meant to neutralize that.
And you said that people with rheumatoid arthritis are not good candidates for this, or they're not candidates for it. Why is that?
There's some systemic conditions, these inflammatory conditions like RA, that can create a collagen inflammation, and your cornea is made out of pure collagen tissue.
Okay.
So a few people get severe dryness or some inflammation of the cornea with or without LASIK surgery. We just don't want to contribute to that concern that these patients can have. It's a rare problem, but one that we're very cautious of.
Is there any eye condition that makes somebody a candidate? And I guess it's that where you say, you know, you really should get LASIK, that's better for you than just wearing glasses or contacts.
I'm not sure if that's a medical or a social question,
gotcha.
But athletes, for example, have been extraordinary candidates for LASIK and not extraordinary candidates for glasses or contacts because of their participation.
Okay.
Done surgery on a number of football players, a number of race car drivers, where contacts and glasses really are a hindrance to your performance.
What about pilots?
Pilots can be fabulous candidates. We're a little careful for commercial pilots because a few people do get some night aberrations with LASIK or with contacts, and those are real issues to commercial pilots. But most people can, and with careful preparation and analysis of their pupil size and what kind of pilot they are. I've done surgery on a number of pilots who are very successfully treated with that.
And as far as night aberrations go, we've heard about things like night blindness. Is that what you're talking about? Or what happens at night that changes how the eyes work?
Early with LASIK, the treatment diameters are very small. The surgery is very rudimentary. And as I said, it could only treat nearsightedness. So some of the very early people did get some night, not blindness, but just some halos, a little radiating glare, things around lights. As the technology advanced in the late 90s, the diameter of treatment went up, the polishing of the edges went up, and night glare that's significant is really unusual today.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about vision impairment and the different options that are out there for people now. A lot has changed in the last 20 years. My guest is Dr. Curtin Kelly. He's an ophthalmologist and director of the Laser Vision Correction at Arena Eye Surgeons. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org as well. A big issue 22 years ago when LASIK surgery first became available in the United States was cost. My recollection, it was, I don't know. I mean, I'm thinking about $5,000 for both eyes. Very expensive for a lot of people, not covered by insurance. The price seems to have come down a lot. But then you have that issue with people saying, well, gosh, I it's kind of like the L'Oreal problem in a way. If you're worth it, you know, aren't my eyes worth $5,000? Is it necessarily, I mean, is there a value there? If you're paying less, you're going to not get as good of treatment.
I'm not sure if it's a linear relationship between cost and outcome, but the average price for LASIK surgery in the United States has remained a little over $2,000 an eye for most of the last 20 years. So you'll see some ads for cheaper numbers here and there. But if you go through the fine print, most people aren't really candidates for that kind of treatment. It requires a minimal amount of LASIK. But if you have a significant prescription, the average cost still has ranged in a little over $2,000 per eye. And that's in large part because of the cost of this technology. You've got, for example, we've got a new device to create these flaps, which allows you to create a very customized flap. But the I call it a toy that we make the flaps with costs over $400,000 to buy this toy. And then royalties are charged by companies that make these. So there's a lot of technological costs to make the outcomes achieve the goals that we all have that makes it very difficult to do this for, I'll call it, deep discount, if you will.
Right. Okay. Yeah. That's good to know. Jim in Westerville, you're on the air. Hi, Jim.
LASIK surgery done about 15 years ago, and it was great. It helped me see from distances. But since then, my ability to see at distances has deteriorated, and my eye doctor says I could get a touch-up done. I could have my ability to see at distances improved, but at the cost of needing to get reading glasses. I'm wondering if there's a technology out there where I could have both. I could have the ability to see at distances and still not need to use reading glasses.
Jim, that's the holy grail of refractive surgeons here. We all want a laser that will keep us from having birthdays. But you're experiencing a problem they call presbyopia, where the lens of your eye is getting a little firmer. I'm assuming you're probably in your 40s now, and you, as I said earlier, be buying bifocals typically. So your doctor's right. If you do a touch-up to get your distance a little clearer, you will lose whatever near vision you now have. And there isn't a laser technique that will allow that to not happen. There are a couple of alternate surgeries that you should know exist that might allow that to be accomplished. One is a surgery we use on cataract surgery patients. Okay. We can put a multifocal or bifocal implant in your eye, and that gives you simultaneous distance and near vision, which is a thing you can't do with LASIK. And another alternative that was just approved last year by the FDA is a little disc, a little wafer with a small pinhole in it, which you can tuck under a LASIK-type flap that keeps your distance good but functions like a pinhole would. If you make a little circle with your fingers and thumb and look through it as a small pinhole, you can see at all distances. And this tries to mimic that by implanting that into your cornea in the center, like a tiny little pupil that gives you near and distance vision. I don't think that's stood the test of time yet, but it just got approval last year, and it's carefully being launched into the U.S. market. So a couple of different ways you can do that, but typical LASIK surgery can't give you distance and near in the same eye.
Okay. All right, Jim, thanks a lot for that call. For people, when it comes to LASIK, I want to get to the cataract surgery. I want to get to those issues. But for people with who have dry eyes or dry eye who've been diagnosed with it, what about that? Does that affect your candidacy for the other stuff?
Well, dry eye is a very common problem, especially this time of year and this kind of climate. So we really work hard to make sure that if you've got dry eye, it's dealt with pre-op, not post-op. LASIK always causes a temporary increase of dryness. So if you start really, really dry, you might not even be a candidate.
Okay.
But most qualified refractive surgeons and corneal specialists will be able to tell if you've got a severe dry eye or what I call a regular dry eye, which is one which can be managed with either lubricants or eyelid margin treatment or sometimes some pills and occasionally even some medications to increase your tear production. So all of these things need to be looked at pre-op. Plus, that gives you a better handle on what your true prescription is. If your eyes are dry, it's very hard to nail down what kind of power you need. And the last thing you want to do is tell the laser to do something that you're not.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be spot on and perfect with it.
So let's talk about cataract surgery. It's the most common surgical procedure in the U.S.,
which
I was surprised to see. And it's had some big, there have been some pretty big advancements. Can you just go over those?
I think we're up to 1.4 to 1.6 million cataract surgeries a year.
Now,
wow. That's not just here in Columbus, but we do this a lot. And the biggest advancements in the past, I would say, 5 or 8 years has been the technology of the actual lens implant. In other words, what kind of outcomes can we expect? All of those of us who've grown up doing refractive LASIK kind of surgery have brought that mentality to our cataract patients, where we really work hard to minimize their dependence on glasses. And one of the biggest areas is the way they've built implants. The two areas where implants now can help cataract patients is with fixing small, medium, and even very high levels of astigmatism and bringing you this multifocal approach where you can get near and far vision. And both of those kind of implants not only are here, not only do they work, but their range of who they can work on has been expanded a lot. So great implant technology is out there now. And the other area of cataract surgery, which has been just a delight to work with, is the actual machinery we use to perform the surgery. There are very sophisticated ultrasonic techniques we use to reduce the size of the cataract and remove it through tiny incisions. And we've even got a couple of femtosecond laser options now to even do some of the previously manual surgical steps for us. Open the eye, open the cataract, soften the cataract, reduce astigmatism, and all that can be really accurately performed with a laser, albeit an expensive one.
As far as what are cataracts? Is it a film over the eye? What is it? What causes it? Just age?
Just about a quarter inch inside your eye is a lens that looks exactly like a lens you would have picked up as a kid and tried to burn a hole in a leaf with.
Okay.
And it's just little. And as that lens, which is supposed to be clear, gets more aged or older, or sometimes from diabetes or other diseases, it gets cloudy. And as that lens gets cloudy, it blocks the flow of light into your eye. It changes how your eyes focus. And when it's coming out, it's called a cataract operation. And when that lens comes out, an implant lens goes in to help you focus.
Let's talk about glaucoma. It's something you treat with eye drops, right? But now they're using something called an eye stent. It's a procedure. What does that do?
Well, glaucoma is an insidious, oftentimes hereditary disease where your eye pressure normally reads in the 10 to 20 range might be a little too high. Well, your eye has what I call hydraulics. There's a flow of fluid into it, and there's a flow of fluid out of it, but it's a closed sphere. So if there more fluid goes in than comes out, the sphere gets tighter and harder.
Gotcha.
And as it gets harder, that pressure can damage the nerve of your eye permanently. And it damages it from the edge to the middle. So you slowly, slowly, imperceptibly lose your peripheral vision until the point where all you have is a little tunnel vision if it's unmanaged.
Uh-huh.
So what we do is either use drops or lasers or surgical things to get your pressure numbers lower. And the eye stent is the latest approved device to be implanted at the time of a cataract operation inside the rim of the anterior chamber of your eye, the front chamber of your eye, to let more fluid out all day, every day, all night, every night without the use of medications.
How big is it?
That thing is probably the size, if you broke off the tip of a sharpened pencil,
okay,
it's probably smaller than that. It's about 0.5 millimeters and 25 millimeters and an inch, so that's tiny. It's a tiny little device. If you put it between your thumb and finger, you wouldn't feel it.
Do people who have glaucoma both typically have it in both eyes?
Typically, yes. There's the sort of garden variety primary glaucoma is a very strongly hereditary and usually bilateral problem. It can be real asymmetric, worse in one eye than the other, but it's typically bilateral.
And so are you still going to be using eye drops even if with the eye stent?
Well, the goal of an eye stent or similar drainage devices is to either reduce or eliminate your need for drops. And most people that have that put in also have a cataract. And actually, that's the only U.S. approved use is to be put in during a cataract operation. So the doctor would take the cataract out, then tilt this person's eye and tuck this tiny little drainage device into the canal where fluid is leaving your eye. And if you look at all the data, about 70% of people that have that reduce or eliminate their need for eye drops, which is a massive medical and cost savings to patients and their insurance and society. So that kind of technique is really going to change the way we treat glaucoma.
Okay. Well, Dr. Curtin Kelly, we're out of time, but I really appreciate you coming in and telling us about this.
Thank you, Anne, so much.
Appreciate it. Dr. Curtin Kelly, he's an ophthalmologist and director of laser vision correction at Arena Eye Surgeons. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Research shows we know that music helps you exercise harder, faster, and longer. So despite what you may have been told, the connection between music and fitness didn't start with Jane Fonda's dance aerobics.
Get the pulse up. March it out and in. And in. Out and in. Out and in. Out and in. Four more, three more, two more, last time, step touch to the right.
I don't know what that just sets something off inside of me that it's not, it can't be good. So how does music impact your exercise? And what are some of the best beats to listen to while working up a sweat? Joining us in the studio is fitness instructor at Szabo Fitness, Chris Szabo. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. Thanks. It's great to be here.
And also personal trainer at Brickhouse Cardio Club, David Lee.
Hello.
Hi, good David. And music curator at Balanced Yoga, Derek DuPont. Welcome to the show, Derek.
Hi, thanks.
I loved it that they had a music curator. I was like, yes! I knew there had to be people like you out there because, you know, I don't think any of you were born when Jane Fonda first came out with these videos. I seriously don't. You might have been a twinkle in someone's eye, Chris, but I don't think so. But things have certainly changed since then. I mean, we have music curators. Mm-hmm. So what do we know about the history of music when you were first starting to teach, David Lee? Mm-hmm. Does it even come up when they're teaching you how to teach?
Oh, yeah. In terms of fitness certifications and group exercise certifications, that's a big component of the training day. So you listen to the music and they have this thing called the 8 count. And so they want to know that you can find the 8 count and cue accordingly and appropriately with the music.
Do you feel like a slave to the music, though, sometimes?
It is. There, in the group fitness world, there are two ways to use the music. And so the traditional Jane Fonda, you know, way is you are enslaved to the music because you have to know when to count. Lately, there's been a lot of other types of group fitness classes that use music more like a not necessarily background music, but they listen for when the chorus comes and they say, okay, now you do this move as many times as you can, as fast as you can. And then when the verse comes, it's a sign to transition to something else. So using it more as like a marker point instead of being right to the music.
Now, Chris Szabo, you use music not to keep a beat.
Right.
But to motivate.
Yeah. So
is it you're motivating or is it your class?
Depends on the day.
Right.
No. I would agree with David that, you know, going through training, it was really important to learn to do that. What I like about my job, and I think what everyone else would appreciate about how I teach, is that it's not hugely choreographed by the beat.
Yeah.
Because I'm not that coordinated. I mean, I teach a very athletic class, but I do use the music to motivate, to raise the energy. And really, the music, and, you know, you can speak to this too as a curator, but it's to really connect with my class. Mm-hmm. And when you see that, when everybody sort of pops up and says, ooh, you know, I know this song, or, you know, all of a sudden, like, they found, like, another level that they can work hard at. So that's what I love about, you know, good music.
In the spirit of full disclosure, Chris Szabo is my instructor at Worthington Rec Center, where she also teaches. And David Lee has subbed for her. So when he walked into the studio, we're like, we know each other.
Yes.
Because he's been my sub teacher there as well. So I do know them both. So I kind of do know their styles. Derek DuPont, music curator at Balanced Yoga. Mm-hmm. Are you also a yoga instructor?
So I'm not currently an instructor.
Okay.
No. It's in the future plans.
Okay.
But not currently.
So I know what a music curator is, but how do you approach what you do?
Yeah, so, it came from kind of an interesting place. I have a large background in music in Columbus, working with CD125, Columbus Songwriters Association, being a musician myself. And so I started getting into it doing yoga to live music. So I'd play guitar to a yoga class where we could set the mood for the yoga class.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, it's a really cool thing that's growing in popularity. And what's cool about that is rather than me actually setting the tone, I actually follow the students a lot. And being live, I can tune into what's going on in the class and follow the instructors and follow the students to really pick up on what they're looking for and what they're going into and actually follow their energy and kind of highlight what they're actually doing.
Unless it's someone like me who's wobbling all over the place trying to get there, and then you just ignore people like that.
Yeah.
Right? Look away.
No, you still make it work.
She is worthless.
Look away. You know, I've noticed lots of different kinds of sound from different yoga classes. Some people, it feels very spiritual. It feels like there's a real culture behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And others, it seems like they try to get away from that. They want it to be more pop.
Yeah, absolutely. And we see lots of different categories of classes. And a lot of it is really dictated by who is instructing that class. For example, we do have classes like that are very spiritual, and they're very much based in the core of yoga. But we also have ones that you're going to go into class and you're going to hear nothing but hip-hop music for 75 minutes straight.
Hmm.
And students, a lot of the time students go to both sides of that. You don't see students picking just one. They like to see both sides of the yoga world. But with that, the teachers can really dive into what they feel works for them. And then the students can see the size of the different teachers in that.
Right, right. Now, Chris, I know you play all kinds of music. How do you decide what you're going to
what's going to happen?
Yeah.
Taking creative liberty is definitely a perk of my job. So I love that, you know, I can change it up all the time. And if I couldn't, ooh, that would be, be rough for all of us, I think.
I've had teachers where they just play the same thing over and over and over and over and over, and over again.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And I mean, with all due respect, I think in some situations, like a big choreographed class, they have to know the song, right?
Right.
Like a step class. That's not the case with mine. But really, it's dictated sort of by my mood and what sort of and also I have talked to people in the class. What appeals to you? What do you want to hear? What motivates you? And if it's in my realm, you know, of interest, I will definitely include that. I mean, there's only certain genres I'm really not going to play in class.
Because of swear words and stuff like that.
Have to be appropriate. It's a community center. And also, you know, it is about beat and stuff like that. And so, you know, we'll slow it down towards the end, as you know, when we stretch. But, it has to be appropriate and fun.
What about you, David Lee? What triggers any decision when it comes to music for you?
For me, it really depends on the class that I'm teaching.
Okay.
So I know that if I'm going to teach like the boot camp class, then I'm going to need something that is a little bit more maybe on the rock side of things. If I teach a Zumba class, then I know I've got to be picking predominantly Latin music or world beat type of music. And then obviously with a hip hop fitness class, then it's just all hip hop. And so once I know the class style that I'm going to teach, then I pick the music that I feel is appropriate for that style of class.
Now, I know you've done CrossFit,
and
when I've seen CrossFit competition on TV, it's just this driving beat the whole time.
Yep.
Is that pretty much what a class is like? I've never been in a class, except for yours, I guess.
Yes.
Mini CrossFit classes.
Yeah, so it is pretty much structured very much like that. The first maybe half of a class is considered the warm-up and the instructional part. So some people kind of joke around that, yeah, CrossFit, you stretch out for 30 minutes and then you work out so hard you want to pass out for the next 30 minutes. but during that instruction part, the music does, they play something kind of on the quieter side just to fill up the, you know, the sound, fill up the space. But then once the actual workout begins after that instructional warm-up part, you are blasting the music as loud as you can. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be, you know, there were some great rock groups, Breaking Benjamin, 3 Days Grace. Those are typical CrossFit-esque type of songs you'd play. So
now we just heard a little bit of Notorious.
Okay.
Yes, we did.
But you curated it very
carefully. I tried
carefully.
To curate it. So we had some good rap there, we just had to it was super fun, and I could tell it was fun. And you know, in picking music, of course, selfishly I will play what I like, but I also want to appeal to my class. So because I know who's in there and the age groups, you know, I can sort of see like what really.
I'm the oldest person.
You are not the oldest person. I mean, maybe second oldest person. But you know, for instance, people's eyes light up when we have 80s music, except for, you know, that one 19-year-old that wasn't born.
Who's like, oh, my God.
Yeah, she was
this
one.
Is my mom's music.
This was a lullaby.
Well, you know, Derek DuPont, what about themes? Because, you know, Chris does themes. I don't know if you do themes like, you know, David Bowie died. Do you find yourself wanting to get into at least that genre and out of respect or that kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. Yes, we do. We have one instructor that actually does a lot of that and likes to do that with different hip-hop artists and dedicates a class to one of them. So he did recently a Drake class that was all inspired by Drake.
Wow.
Yeah, so and people connect with that, people that like different music and even people that maybe aren't even huge Drake fans. They still like the idea that, like, okay, we're going to go to a class and it's going to be all one artist. Like, what is that like? How does that work? And it's cool because you can take a whole body of work from an artist and you can pick songs that really that feed that and that can actually go with the flow of the class instead of just having it be constant one thing. It can be you can pick a slower song to start with and you get up to a certain peak and then you can slow it back down towards the end when you start to relax a little bit more.
Now, Chris, if somebody said they wanted to do an all David Bowie class, what would you?
Well, There's been a few requests for that, and it's coming, actually.
Oh.
I'm a little late to the punch because we do have someone out there that requested this a long time ago. And now it just really seems appropriate to do this.
But you've been popping in a few Bowie songs here.
I have been. And actually, that last song, some people didn't quite know that that was Bowie singing America, but it's okay.
What about you, David Lee? Do people get requests from?
Yeah, I do. I actually ask for requests as well, especially when it comes to the music, dance, fitness classes, because I found that for the dance fitness classes, especially if the music isn't danceable, then it really lowers the motivation. So, I have kept up to date on the latest and greatest hits. You know, when I first came to Columbus, I had no idea who Fetty Wap was until somebody said, "Hey, can you play Fetty Wap?" And I was, "How do you spell that?" And I started listening. And so it's nice because it expands my own listening library. I would have never heard of this guy.
Yeah. Can you see the effect music has on people in your classes?
Yeah, especially when I've taught some maybe poorly constructed classes, usually it was because I didn't pick a good opening song. And so it was a song that a lot of times I really liked, but then, you know, opening up the song and then I can just see people's faces and their energy level, and there's kind of a feel in the room that I'm just realizing, oh, this was not a good, you know, song. And so, and then for me personally, I'm the kind of instructor that if the first opening song doesn't go well, it's an uphill, you know, battle to try and motivate instructors. And so I really put a lot of thought actually into the very first song.
Yeah, and sometimes that first song is before the class even starts, so you're kind of setting the mood. I know you use Blue Man Group, don't you?
I use a lot of Blue Man Group to have out there.
Yeah. That's a good idea.
And
I'll
another,
just do that.
It's totally fine. Another one I really like is just the Hard Work. It's like a theme for like the Army uses a lot. So a lot of instrumental or like drums is kind of fun. Yeah, just to kind of get people upbeat. But I think that opening sort of hanging out music is a big deal. You know, because we do have people hanging out before class getting set up. And I think that that's an opportunity to set the stage. And that opening song is a big deal.
Derek DuPont, same thing with the yoga.
Yeah, for sure. And even beyond that, too, I had an interesting point that I just thought of in this whole thing. So I do a lot with powerlifting and CrossFit as well.
Okay.
I have a company that does the Wild Path, where we exist to bring music and fitness together.
Okay.
And we do it kind of through yoga live music and through other things as well, DJing. We do all the music for the Arnold, the CrossFit at the Arnold.
Oh, okay. Oh,
wow. Yeah. So with that, it's interesting because in powerlifting, it's a very different use for music, where it traditionally is not, there's no music involved with powerlifting.
Yeah.
It's a very quiet sport. It's a very concentrated sport. But we, in partnership with a gym in Hilliard called Endeavor, we have actually brought music into it to kind of make it a little bit more relevant, where people that are observers, they can actually feed off of the energy of the music and not just be just watching. They can actually feel the energy of what's happening there. And so we have some lifters that once they hear the music, they're like, actually, I want you to keep this up the whole time, even when I'm hitting my lift.
I wonder if it's changed the culture of powerlifting.
It is, actually. And we've seen it. We've done this for the past 3 years now. And the first year, it was very strange. People were kind of surprised by it, and some people were offended that there was music, and which you can expect with it.
What did Arnold think?
Well, so Arnold, with CrossFit, so we do that at the Arnold. We do it with CrossFit.
Okay.
And so with that, it is constantly driving, high energy, and it's great, and it fits that very well.
Yeah.
With the powerlifting, that we haven't done at the Arnold with the music. We've done that at private competitions, but the lifters are reacting to it all differently. That some of them, they wanted to keep going where they hit their lifts. Some of them, they want it up and then cut it off as soon as I like get up to the bar.
Oh.
Like, turn it off right now. I'm about to hit my lift. And like, I need to concentrate now. But they like the energy before it. They all enjoy that energy before it. But it's been interesting to see it kind of evolve and people start to use that more during their lifts in a way that they never did before.
Well, as I expected when I booked this, the time has just flown by. So thanks to Chris Szabo, fitness instructor at Szabo Fitness. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
Derek DuPont, music curator at Balanced Yoga and in many other places as well, apparently. Thanks for joining us. And David Lee, personal trainer at Brickhouse Cardio Club. Thanks to you.
Yes, thank you.
And thanks to all our listeners. You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.